Good afternoon, everybody. I don't have anything to hide behind, like they said, so. We have to improvise sometimes in what we're doing here. So, are we going to improvise a slide up on top? There we go. Okay. All right. Well, as you probably guessed, today is Hoshana Rabbah. It's a word that means multitude or great salvation. And in Jewish tradition, it's also called the last great day. And we just witnessed a reenactment of this very special tradition that took place every year during the Feast of Tabernacles in the first century. You know, I don't really believe that the Jews understood what they were doing oftentimes when they went through some of these traditions of theirs. But nevertheless, they are recorded for our benefit, and we can see 2,000 years later what God was doing back then and how he used these traditions to help paint a story of salvation for the people of God. This whole tradition of Hoshana Rabbah and the water pouring ceremony, it pictures something that's going to happen yet into the future. And I believe it's going to happen during the latter part of the millennium, maybe 600-700 years into the millennial period. And during that time, there's going to be a great outpouring of God's Holy Spirit, much more so than at any time in history up to this point. And maybe greater than any time in all history, even up to that point. In fact, the prophet Joel, as we saw, if I turn it on, it works. Yes. The prophet Joel says in chapter 2, verse 28, "And it shall come to pass afterward that I will pour out my spirit on all flesh, and also on my men servants and my maid servants I will pour out my spirit in those days." And as we saw in the play, Yeshua reiterated this same point when he said, "If anyone thirst, let him come to me and drink, and whoever believes in me, as the scripture has said, out of his heart will flow rivers of living water." And as it was depicted in the play that we saw, he was probably waiting for that time to happen. It was something that he wanted to say probably from his early childhood, and God had presented him and told him that there would be a time when you would be able to convey this message, and he gave it to them right at that correct time. Okay, we're working on electronics back there. But the prophecies speak, this prophecy in Joel and this prophecy in John speaks of a time when God's people would be ready to receive the Spirit. Apparently there's going to be a time in the future when there will be a resurrection to life of people who have never had an opportunity to see the things of God, to hear the things of God. And when he does perform this great resurrection, or maybe it's something that will happen throughout the millennium, we don't know. Whatever happens, I'm sure it's going to be the right thing. We may not have our eschatology correct, but I'm sure that whatever happens, God, it's going to work out according to God's plan. But when that happens, there's going to have to be people who are going to be available to take these people who have received this spark of the Holy Spirit, and be able to take and work with those people and teach them just as we are today. Because for most of us, we've seen that when God opened our eyes to hearing and understanding, what did we do? We started searching out a teacher, didn't we? We started looking for people who could help explain to us these awesome things that we were beginning to see, things that we had read about for years and years and never had truly understand. You know, God's an awesome God. We sing about it all through the festival. He can do anything. You know, God, if he had wanted to, could have taken and raised the ground where Noah lived. And he could have made a pathway for all the animals to come up to this piece of ground, maybe a mile square, or I don't know how big it would have to be, for all of the animals to go up to, and then Noah and his family would be living up there, and God could have protected that from anybody else coming up there and saved Noah all these years of building an ark. But he didn't choose to do it that way, did he? You know, God could have snapped his finger and the temple would have suddenly appeared. And Solomon wouldn't have had to work for, 7 years building the temple? It could have happened that way if God had wanted to. You know, God could have brought Yeshua in the electronic age, the age of TVs and smartphones. And then instead of him standing on the corner of the temple saying, out of his belly will flow rivers of living water, he could have simply got in front of a TV set or a TV camera and broadcast it all over the world. It could have happened that way, but it didn't. What did he do instead? God chose to work through human beings to get his message across. He worked through human beings to teach about his salvation. He worked through a human being to save all mankind in a flood. It's very clear, God works through human beings. During Hoshana Rabbah, a spark is going to light up the fire of the Holy Spirit, and millions and probably billions of people who had never heard about God, never heard about Yeshua, never heard about this way of life. And there's going to have to be people ready to begin to teach. In the book of Haggai, it talks about a time. It's a time when the Jewish people were sent back to Jerusalem to begin to build the temple. But they built the walls of Jerusalem first, and they got that all completed and secure. And then they started on the temple. And they got started on the temple, and then they stopped. And they started building their own houses, started taking care of themselves. And so God sent Haggai with a little bit of encouragement to them. And on the 21st day of the 7th month, which day is that? Anybody know? Hoshana Rabbah. On this day, 2,500 years ago, God sent this message by the prophet Haggai, and he said, yet once more in a little while, let me just put it up there. Oh, I got it up there. Okay. Yet once more in a little while, I will shake the heavens and the earth and the sea and the dry land, and I will shake all nations so that the treasures of all nations shall come in, and I will fill this house with glory, says Yahweh of hosts. I believe this passage speaks of a time when God will draw all his people to the temple. I believe there'll be a steady stream of peoples from all the different parts of the world. They're going to wake up one morning and they're just going to start understanding things. These people, these Hebraic people who lived over in that part of town, these people who seemed to always be happy, these people who had good, well-behaved children, these people who seemed to always be at peace, they're going to start saying, what is it about those people that's different? You know, I ought to go check them out and see what they're doing that's different. And there's going to have to be those communities all over the world that can be checked out. You know, 3,500 years ago, God gave the Israelite people a mandate, and he did it through the prophet Moses. And Moses said, and this is in regards to the Torah, he says, keep them and do them, for they will be your wisdom and your understanding in the sight of the peoples who, when they hear all these statutes, will say, surely this great nation is a wise and understanding people. For what great nation is there that has God so near to it as Yahweh, our God, is to us whenever we call upon him? And what great nation is there that has statutes and rules so righteous as all this law, all this Torah that I have set before you this day? Moses was spelling out the mandate for Israel. That was the mandate that Israel had back then And I submit to you that it's the mandate that Israel has today. And it's the mandate that God intends for Israel to carry out in the millennial kingdom. God is looking for us to be an example. If we are Israel and we have a mandate, then we have an example to show. We have an example to exemplify, because God is going to be glorified by our example. In Hoshana Rabbah, when Yahweh pours out His Spirit, during that time, there are going to be these pockets again of people that the nations are going to be drawn to, the people who all of a sudden are waking up to this great, awesome understanding. They're going to need these pockets, these people that they can go to in order to where they can learn about God's way of life. How will this come to pass? I believe it's going to come to pass by people, Hebraically minded people, raising strong families and building strong Torah fellowships. You know, in 1996, a book came out. It was written, quote unquote, by the First Lady of the United States. Her name is Hillary Clinton. And it was entitled, It Takes a Village and Other Lessons Children Teach Us. It focused on the impact that people outside the family have on children within the family. And I knew just very little about the book. In fact, I basically discounted the book, disregarded the book, because I was a Rush Limbaugh fan. And so if Hillary Clinton wrote it, it couldn't be good, could it? And so I discounted the book. I never really thought about much about it. I thought it was just a bunch of liberal, Democrat gibberish. But soon I began to think about the things that had happened to me in my life, and how there were people who had an impact on me. We talked about mentors yesterday. Dr. Merritt mentioned it, and I had a mentor. His name was Bob Wellmaker. And Bob Wellmaker sort of took me under his wing and helped me along. And he helped me get started in my business, just like this doctor helped Dr. Merritt. People outside of your family can help out a lot. And as I went on through life and my children began to grow, I realized that my children had people who made impact on their lives. We had a teacher. Her name was Harriet Erickson, who made a tremendous impact on my children. And there's others as well. So people have an impact on us. Other people have an impact on us. And that's good and proper. That's the way God intends for things to do, or things to be. So as I began to study these things and learn more about these things, I realized that this village thing was probably not that bad of an idea. That it's probably good that we have villages to help us raise our children, to help us to take and grow in this walk. It was something certainly to be considered. Well, you know, God does work through villages. We might call them communities. The Bible sometimes refers to them as clans and tribes. And in Israel, one of the smallest organized units was the family. You had a husband and a wife, and then you had children, and they became a family, a mishpachah. And then when groups of families came together, they would form what was called a clan. And God used these clans in very specific ways. One good example is we find in Numbers 3, where God took all of the different clans of the Levites and assigned them different functions in regards to the tabernacle and carrying the tabernacle from place to place. So clans work together to do the work of God. They perform the service of God. And as Israel got into the land and began to settle into the land, those clans grew into communities and villages. And thus they would perform the same work throughout all Israel. They would be performing the work of God. These Torah communities, let's call them, did the work of God throughout the land of Israel. And so for the next few minutes, I want to talk about Torah communities and fellowships. And I want to focus on three specific points. They are the need for community, obstacles to building strong fellowships and communities, and how to begin a Torah fellowship. So let's start with a need for community. And I'll start by giving you my own example. I spent the better part of my life as a part of a thriving Torah community. We had a common goal. We worked together to bring that goal to fruition. When I was 10 years old, my dad, on Christmas Day, made this statement. You boys and girls enjoy it. This is the last Christmas. And at that point, my life changed tremendously. So did the lives of my brothers and my sister. You see, back then, Christmas parties were a pretty big thing, especially if you went to public school. And so Christmas was probably one of the hardest changes for us to make. I was in the fourth or fifth grade. I don't remember exactly which one it was. But I remember that first year that we were not going to keep Christmas, and thus we weren't going to be a part of the Christmas party. And so I took this note to school, and I handed it to the teacher, and I told the teacher, my mommy gave me this note. I can't go to the Christmas party. And she said, what are you, a Jew? Well, I don't know what I was. I just knew I couldn't keep the Christmas party. But it was hard. It was very difficult. Thankfully, the Christmas party was on the last day of school before the break, and so by the time 2 weeks passed and school started, my friends had already forgotten about this little cultish behavior that we had done by not going to the Christmas party. But this continued on for me through junior high school and even early into early high school. We would continue to bring notes from my parents to school, and we would get out of school during the parties. We couldn't do the Christmas party, couldn't do the Easter party, couldn't do the Halloween party. We could do the Thanksgiving party. So that was good. And then I became a freshman in high school. And as a freshman, well, let me just back up here a little bit. I took and just before my freshman year, we had moved from Nashville, Tennessee to Cleveland, Tennessee. And in Cleveland is where I started in high school as a freshman. And it just so happened, I guess I had a good band teacher when I was in Nashville, because when I went to Cleveland and I tried out for band, I ended up as first chair as a freshman. I was the first chair trumpet player in the Cleveland High School in my freshman year. But that didn't last very long, because when the band director found out that his first chair trumpet player could not march on Friday night, he found another first chair trumpet player. And when we found out that we could not play certain songs in the Christmas concert, he found someone else to be first chair. Well, thankfully, we didn't stay in Ardmore, in Cleveland that long, and we eventually moved to Ardmore, Oklahoma. And in 1969, my mom and dad, we were living in Ardmore, Oklahoma in a little trailer park, and my dad decided that we were going to start going to this church that he had been reading things from for the last 7 years. And when we went to church, it changed things. Because when we went to church, we drove in an hour and 15 minutes to church. When we got to church, I met people who were my age, who were also being drawn out of school for the Christmas party, and also drawn out of school for various other functions. And all of a sudden, I felt at ease. And in fact, all of a sudden, I felt like now I could go back to school and have a little bit more confidence, you might say, because I wasn't the only one that was so freakish. How many of you felt the same way? Yeah, I see some hands out there. Okay. So I'm in good company. The Sabbath no longer became an obstacle or an embarrassment. You know, my friends there at church, we would share war stories of things that happened at school and all of that. We'd talk about that teacher did this to me. Well, what do your teachers do when you bring that note? You know, and all of that type of thing. But we did learn together to deal with the ridicule and the harassment. Because, you know, back then, if you didn't keep Christmas, you were really weird. Right? It's not that way now. A lot has changed in 30, 40 years. Back then, you were really weird if you didn't keep Christmas. You know, this church that we became part of was a community. It was something where we could come together. We felt at ease. There was people that we thought the same way we did. They shared the same problems we had. They shared the same excitements we had. It was a community. We need communities. Teenagers need communities. I know that because many of you who registered, you wrote in notes or you called me and said, my teenagers want to come. You guys didn't want to come, but your teenagers wanted to come. All right? So I know there's a number of you are here because of your teenagers. Teenagers like to be around community. Well, as time went on, I grew up got a little bit older, and we moved to Big Sandy, Texas, I moved to Big Sandy, Texas for 2 weeks, but I met this awesome woman. And started dating her, and my 2 weeks turned into 35 years. But it was in Big Sandy that I learned about peer pressure. Now, we talk about peer pressure a lot, and I believe peer pressure is a good thing. Because in Big Sandy, Texas, where I got married and I raised my children, it was the second headquarters for this church that we had become a part of. And within a 25-mile radius of where we lived, there was over 500 Sabbath-keeping families. Probably more. But at least 500 Sabbath-keeping families. There were so many families in the town that we lived in that were affected by our church community that the school board in Hawkins, Texas scheduled their fall festival, their fall breaks, to match the Feast of Tabernacles. We made an impact on that school. Back then, secrets were hard to keep if you were a part of the church we were a part of. If you went to a Friday night football game and you were a part of the church, it soon got back to everybody else that you were there. If you went to a movie on Shabbat, people found out about it. And then you know what they would do? They would often give you a call and say, hey, I heard about this or I heard about that. You know, that was good. That was good. Because, you know, the Bible supports the concept that when your brother takes and gets outside of the community walk, you should try to your best to bring him in. This is in Leviticus 19, verse 17. It says, you shall not hate your brother in your heart. You shall surely rebuke your neighbor and not bear sin because of him. You know, this is part of the you shall love your neighbor as yourself context. To love your neighbor as yourself means that you go out and you help your brother stay on the walk. And if your brother gets outside of the walk, you go talk to your brother and help bring him back in. That's all part of being a Torah community. Peer pressure helped many of us maintain the walk. Because for people who are new into this walk, it's often hard to make these changes that God's asking of us to make. And a little extra inspiration along the way sometimes helps us. It's not a bad thing at all. Not a bad thing at all. As a Torah community, you help your brother when he's weak. You know, peer pressure also helped our children quite a bit. My boys were in band, and they were often the best ones in the band in regards to the instruments they played. They are often the ones that were best in regards to marching, or at least knowing the marches, because they never got to march, except when there was competitions that happened to fall on a Friday or a Sunday or something like that. But they weren't alone in school. Because in our school, just like I said, there was a lot of other children with the same walk as they had. And so, like for instance, my oldest son, in fact, both my boys played basketball, played varsity basketball, and they were very good at basketball. And they would play varsity basketball on Friday until just before sundown. And it's just about 5 minutes before sundown, the coach called a timeout, and then most of the first string came off the floor and went to the locker room and changed. Now, that would be hard if you were by yourself, wouldn't it? But four out of five, I think, of the first string varsity basketball players went to the same church. And they all kept the Sabbath. And so that helped them. It was this community they were part of that helped them out. Having a close Torah community makes it easier for everyone to stay in tune with God and his Hebraic walk. So that's one of the reasons why it's important to have a community, why we need communities. You know, the idea of building Torah fellowships is not my idea. I believe it's a scriptural idea. And I know many of you out there want to build Torah fellowships too. I've heard you talk about it. But oftentimes when you talk about the need for Torah fellowships, you always include the obstacles that keep you from forming those same fellowships. Some of these obstacles include distance, differences in biblical understanding, and lack of male leadership. I would submit to you that even though this is the order that I hear when people are talking about Torah fellowships, because I'm big into Torah fellowships. I think we need to establish them. But when I hear people talk about it, usually distance is the first thing that they talk about. But I would submit to you that the real underlying reason would be found in reverse order from what I've got up here. And so I want to talk about the obstacles to building strong fellowships, and I want to start first with what I think is probably the biggest problem, and that is the lack of male leadership. The lack of male leadership. Why is it that men have a hard time in spiritual matters? Why is it meant that men don't want to lead these types of things? Why is it they're just not interested in getting together with other people and starting something that's going to benefit their children, benefit their family as a whole? You know, it's interesting. I've talked to some people who say that they would like to be a part of a fellowship. In fact, they at one time were a part of a fellowship, but it was led by women. And I just had a hard time with it because it was led by this woman. Well, my answer to him is, then why don't you lead it? Why don't you just take the reins and run with it and go and lead this fellowship or start a fellowship of your own or take more active part in the fellowship that she's leading? Because I would believe, Angie's looking at me with this. I don't know about that. I would dare say that in time, most women would gladly give up their Torah fellowships if they're leading them, because they only started them because a man wouldn't do it, right? You know, men have been made to look lame and foolish for the past 50 years. I talked about this the other day. But you know, guys, that's just no excuse. It's just no excuse for us not being willing to step forward and take the lead in probably one of the biggest roles that God has given us. And that is to lead the spiritual lives of our children and our wives. We should be the ones out there. You know, you guys have got to face it. The time when you walked out of that church and said goodbye to that pastor, you walked away from the opportunity to go simply sit in a chair and listen and then leave. You've got to go ahead and rise to the occasion, guys. You've got to get out there. You've got to begin leading. You can't sit in the pew anymore. You've got to be on the front lines. You've got to begin to lead. You know, it's not going to happen if you don't make it happen. You've got to just get out there and get started. You don't have to be a preacher to start a fellowship. There's many ways to get it started, and there's many roles within a fellowship. You know, if you're not a preacher or you're not a teacher, you can say, hey, I just got through renting the community center. Let's all come together this Sabbath. Email your friends and have them come, and then you could start. Many fellowships start as a result of Torah studies, and we'll get into that later. But let's talk about the next obstacle. The next obstacle is differences in biblical understanding. Mark Roth sort of mentioned this the other day in regards to some of the problems that congregations face. It's these differences in biblical understanding about a number of things. You know, there's topics out there that simply are not going to be resolved in our day. We just need to come to face it and move on. In Season of Our Joy, there are four topics we don't talk about. And the reason we don't talk about them in main sessions or breakout sessions is because they're nothing but divisive. They're just simply divisive. And so we don't talk about the calendar. We don't talk about the nature of God. We don't talk about the pronunciation of the sacred name, and we don't talk about kosher foods because it could become divisive. So we're going to move on past those things. We're just going to have fun then, right? Can we do that? All right. Okay, if we can do that here, and I'm looking at probably 300 to 400 people right now. If we can do it here, why can't you do it in a little small group? Well, I know why, because we don't want to. That's guys, you know. We just don't want to. We need to come to realize that it's not our responsibility to restore all things. Whose responsibility is it? Elijah's. It's Elijah's responsibility to restore all things. So if we read there in Malachi where it says that Elijah is going to restore all things, why do we feel like we have to restore it? Why can't we just sit back, relax, do the best we can with what we've got, and go on and fellowship together and put aside the things that are divisive between us? I think God is not pleased when we let calendar issues separate us. Because when you really think about it, how many days a year will calendar issues keep you from fellowshipping together? Actually, none. But we could say seven, okay? There's seven Moedim, all right? And so we could get together on all, you know, we could get together on 52 other days. And there'd be no calendar issues involved. Well, All right, for most of us, we can get together on 52 days that we can all agree on, right? Okay. We should not let the calendar, we should not let the name Yahweh divide us. You know, I speak occasionally in a sacred names group in Edom, Texas. And they invite me there. And when I speak, I sometimes say, Jesus. And you know what? They haven't thrown me out yet. They still let me come. And I bring our whole fellowship sometimes. And they like us to come because we dance. And they love it. So, you know, we don't need to let these little things separate us and keep us from fellowshipping together. While we're at it, I want to talk about another thing that sometimes divides fellowships. And what's more so than dividing fellowship, it keeps fellowships from growing. And that is inappropriate topics. Can you think of any inappropriate topics? My wife can. Go ahead. What the sacred name is? Okay, you heard me there. Any new ones? Polygamy. Why is it that it seems like every last fellowship has to go through this polygamy problem? Why can't we just set it aside? You know, it's one of the most embarrassing things to have somebody new come into your fellowship and the guys start talking about polygamy. Now, we talk about polygamy in our fellowship. We talk about how bad it is. We talk about how it's never successful. We talk about how God may have legislated it, but certainly didn't want it. But we should avoid that topic at all cost because it does nothing to build a relation or a fellowship. And I would submit to you that it will drive people away. It almost drove us away from our first Hebrew Roots fellowship. Certainly did. So inappropriate topics, I'm sure there's others, but that's the one that always comes to mind because I know that's the one that's being dealt with. In fact, I got a indication that this meeting down here that was held that kept some people up till 3 o'clock in the morning, they were discussing polygamy. What an awful thing to be talking about at the Feast of Tabernacles. Okay, now there's another thing that we talk about, or people discuss with me in regards to why they have a hard time starting or being with a fellowship, and that is distance. You know, the distance one is the easiest one to solve. It's the easiest thing to solve. I'm just going to remind you again, the thing that turned my life and helped me the most is when my parents started going to church an hour and 15 minutes away. And we did it every Sabbath. And I was a teenager at that time. And that helped me tremendously. It's such an easy fix. In our fellowship, when we started the Ami Israel Fellowship about 8.5 years ago, we started it in a centralized location. At least we thought it was central. We went to Gladewater, Texas. Gladewater is about 20 minutes from us, 20 minutes from the people in Longview, 20 minutes from the people in Tyler. We thought it was a good central location, and we got this group from Ben Wheeler, this family from Ben Wheeler. Are they here? Wes? There they are back there. They have to drive an hour. But they come every week. And so we're going to try to move a little bit further west when we move. We're hopefully going to be able to move soon. But it's an easy fix. Let me ask you something. How many of you would drive 30 minutes to the mall? How many of you would drive 30 minutes to go to a movie? How many of you would drive 30 minutes to a football game? How many drive 4 hours to a football game? Yeah, I see some back there. Mark Roth would drive halfway across the country to watch the Green Bay Packers. So, if we are willing to do that, why is it such a problem to drive an hour to make sure your family is part of a fellowship? Well, I'll tell you what. I've heard people say, well, I'd have to drive 20 minutes. You know, we're used to this church thing where there's a church on every corner, aren't we? Well, guys, there's not a Hebraic church on every corner. You're going to have to get past that. You're going to have to realize that we've got to walk a ways or get in our car and drive a ways because that's behind us, right? We're moving forward. And so moving forward means we're going to have to take and plan a little bit earlier in the morning, you know, get out of bed a little bit earlier, and so that we can get in the car and be to our fellowship on time. And in so doing, you'll help your children tremendously. Absolutely tremendously. You know, I have employees, and we try to work with our employees and some of their personal problems at times. We try not to get too involved, but, you know, sometimes our employees have a hard time getting to work on time. Sometimes they'll have a hard time with their wife calling them all day long on the cell phone. What's some of the other things, Jason? I mean, all kinds of stuff. But we have all these problems that our employees have, but the bottom line that we tell our employees is that if you want to fix it, you'll fix it. If you don't, you won't. If it's important to you, you'll take care of it. If it's important to you to get to work on time, you'll get to work on time. If it's important to you to stay focused on your job and not have your wife call you every 5 minutes, then you're going to do it. You'll work it out. You'll tell your wife to call you at these break times or something like that. If it's important to you, you'll do it. If it's important to you to go to a Torah fellowship, you'll make it work. You'll make it work. Now, before starting our, let me do this here. How to begin a Torah fellowship? Do you need a preacher to start a fellowship? Do you need a teacher? Do you need a band? No, you don't. One of the easiest ways to start a Torah fellowship, if you're not a teacher, is to do a Torah study. You've got a syllabus right there. 52 times a year. You got something different every time to talk about. Everybody knows what you're going to talk about. All you have to do is do a little bit of reading ahead of time. Maybe open up a few little commentaries and see what's going on. And you've got an instant Torah fellowship. It's really easy to do. There's no real formula to starting a fellowship, but it won't happen if you don't do something. It won't happen if you don't get started. Before starting our fellowship, I asked a number of people in our area if they would like to be a part of a Torah fellowship that we were planning or hoping to start. Angie and I had for a number of years hosted various activities, Hanukkah celebrations, Yom Teruah celebrations. And so we had a number of people who knew us and we knew them. And so when we got ready to start our fellowship, we just put an email out to all of these people, about 60 different families who had come regularly to the activities that we had hosted. And we told them we would like to start a fellowship, meet every Sabbath, let our kids come together. And we found a neutral place, like I said, is in Gladewater. It's a little community building in the housing authority there. And it worked real well that first week. We had about, 30 people that first week. Next week we had two or is it three? We didn't have very many that next week. So Angie and I, before we started the fellowship, we had made a commitment. We were going to do this for a year. And so every week we went. And we would wait to see who showed up. And I would I would go look through the blinds and say, is anybody else coming? Please, somebody else come. Because we like to dance, and Angie and I didn't want to dance just by ourselves. So, anyway, thankfully we did have an older lady. Her name is Janice. Janice, if you're hearing us right now. She was very steady in coming, and then we had others came, and the fellowship grew. Sometimes we would have 10 one week, and then the next week we'd have 4, and up and down, up and down, up and down, and now we're fellowship averages around 30, 35 people on a week. It's taken 8.5 years to get there. But I am just awed that we're where we're at. And it's such a blessing. Every Sabbath, it's a blessing to come to our fellowship. Every Sabbath. And by the way, almost all of our fellowship is here at this feast this year. So we are tickled pink. Here are some things you might want to consider when you, if you're getting ready to start a fellowship. If you'd like to start a fellowship, I can speak through experience. We've tried it twice. We've been successful once. And I think I've learned a few things along the way. One of the important things to remember is to be structured. Be structured. Come up with a plan. Come up with a way you're going to do things, a schedule of things, so that not only you know what's going on, but others know what's going on. You know, people coming out of the churches are used to structure, aren't they? But they get into many Torah fellowships or small groups or home fellowships, and there's really no structure. And they feel way out of place because of the lack of structure. And I would submit to you that because of the lack of structure, many of them go into a very structured system called Judaism. And so, be structured. Have a schedule and follow it. And then be on time. If you start at 12 o'clock, start at 12 o'clock. Even if nobody's there, start at 12 o'clock. We start here on time because that's the proper things to do. You know, one of the things I hated about going to some of these home fellowships was they said, well, we're going to start at 2 o'clock. And so we'd get there, and at the time we had both of our boys at home still, and we would get there and take the boys, and they wouldn't start till 3. And it's sort of frustrating to get all ready and then them not show up, you know, not get started. They may have decided they were going to have a prayer vigil. Okay. So they may have decided to do that, or maybe they decided, oh, let's just go ahead and eat now. Okay. Well, be structured. Let people know what you're going to do and then do it. That helps tremendously, especially for newcomers who are expecting to see a certain structure. Maybe they know at this point when I'm going to get out of here. Okay? But if you mess the schedule up or don't follow the schedule, then you may have left them for good. Or they may have left you for good. I would submit that it would be important to encourage traditions in a fellowship. Traditions sort of set you apart. They make your fellowship unique. We have traditions in our fellowship. I think they're good. One of our traditions, actually it's halakha, it's a law. We don't bend very much in this law, and that law goes like this. If you bring pecan pie to the oneg, you have to bring 2. That's our law. Because I just love pecan pie, and I'm usually the last one through the line, or try to be close to the last through the line, and I don't like to see it all gone before I get there. So we have this tradition, but we also have other traditions. We take and get together on new moons, and it's our tradition to go to a different person's home each month on new moon. And we've just started another tradition. One of the fellows in our fellowship, Jonathan Stahl, who's helping us back here on the recording, he started a tradition us once a month. Let's all come to his house and just sit around and chat. It's a good thing. And traditions are very, very helpful. You know, we have a tradition here. Where do you see in the Bible that we're supposed to sing, Awesome God? and wave our lulaving to it. But it's our tradition, and I can tell you, everybody enjoys it because the floor is crowded, right? So tradition is good, really good, really good. Another thing to do is to use everyone's talents. Not everybody is a preacher. Not everybody is a speaker. But everybody has a talent. And so find out the talents of those people in your fellowship and use them. Our brochure was put together by a couple in our fellowship who are graphic artists. They don't teach much. They go out and visit our elderly. They go to the hospitals. They do a lot of things that I can't do, things that I don't feel comfortable doing. They do those for us. They pick up our key every week to get into our fellowship. Everybody has a function, and you don't all have to be teachers and all have to be preachers. Use everybody's talents. Pass a sign-up list around so that, and list on there all of the different things that need to be done and ask the people to fill out those spots. We do that every week. And then we post it on a part of our internet, on our website, where everybody can go to it and see, check, and see what their responsibility is. While they're driving to the fellowship on the Sabbath, they can download it on their little smartphone and say, oh, I'm supposed to set up this morning. So, you know, it's a good thing to do. Encourage and honor the elderly in the fellowship. Miss Janice, I talked about earlier, it's our tradition to let Janice always open, be the first reader in the Torah study. Not that she's the best reader. In fact, right now she doesn't really like reading much anymore, so she usually reads the first verse and lets the next person read. But we honor her by giving her this special honor that's exclusively hers. So honor the elderly. We have an elderly fellow, gentleman, who Angie and I really look up to. We don't agree with everything that he teaches, he believes. But we really look up to him because he helped us out in a very difficult time, him and his wife. And we honor what he says, though we don't necessarily agree with it all the time. Usually we do, but not every time. But we honor him. Avoid controversy. We've talked about that before. When we have controversial topics that we want to discuss, we usually do them in a presentation, not as a Torah study, or not as part of our Torah study, because I feel it's best for us to present these things and then take questions on it. Go ahead and get your case out there and then take questions on it. And then your questions may cause you to decide that, well, you didn't see it quite right. And so you change, and then maybe a few months later you bring it back up again. But don't bring the controversial things in your Torah study. They will do nothing but ruin the rest of your day. Be cognizant of those who are visiting that day. And then one of the important things is that, and that we all have to do, is we need to learn the difference between doctrine and halakha. You know, there are churches out there that have a doctrine that says you cannot dance. Have any of you been a part of one of those? Okay, but we knew that's not in the Bible, is it? Now, if it's their halakha, if that's what they've decided to do in their fellowship, that's fine. I don't have a problem with that. You know, I know that the Bible says that I can have strong drink during this festival. But what are we doing in this festival? We're honoring the halakha of the host right here by not drinking alcohol. But there is a nice little Mexican restaurant down the road. So you honor the halakha and make a difference, distinction between the halakha and the doctrine. Okay? Avoid controversy. Encourage additional fellowship. Move your fellowship after the fellowship is over to the next place, like we do over here with Mr. Stahl. And then the last is stick with it. Don't give up because no one shows up. Pray about it. Let God add to it as He sees fit. And if he sees fit, he'll add to it. So don't give up because you don't have a lot of people coming. Just as ancient Israel was divided into families, clans, and tribes, I believe that Israel today will also need to be formed into small communities. With small Hebraic communities led by Torah-pursuant men, we can begin to make an impact in our cities and our towns. A young lady named Shauna Dose made this statement the other day. She said, "This world is a hungry world." Hoshana Rabbah is about feeding the world. Feeding the world with the bread of life. Bringing living water to the countless billions of people who have never seen the light of the Messiah. Who have never been called into this walk in this way. This is going to take place in the Messianic Kingdom, a kingdom that's yet to come. And our job is to restore what we can restore and build fellowships that are going to help us to be established when this time comes, when God opens the eyes of all these peoples. These fellowships are not going to just snap into place. I've yet to see God just snap his fingers and things started happening. He's always done it through people. We need to set aside our differences and join together so that we can be the light of the world. These are the days of Elijah. We are building strong families in troubling times. At least we're attempting to do so. It's Elijah's job to begin and to carry out this restoration. And I believe there in Malachi where it talks about Elijah restoring the hearts of the fathers to the children, I believe that that means... that God is going to teach us to love God so much and see him as our deliverer, just as our fathers, Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, did. And when we do, I believe our children will turn their hearts to us and to the fathers as well. You know, God calls Israel his congregation, his bride, and his children. This past week, we've had a number of messages, both in this room and in all the various breakout session rooms on this campus. And these messages have been pointed toward building strong families and strong congregations. As we close this Feast of Tabernacles this evening and begin a whole new festival, the Festival of Shemini Atzeret this evening, I hope we'll put into practice the things that we've learned this past week. And we'll follow the admonition of one of the most gifted writers in the Bible. He wrote an epistle, and this epistle he wrote to a group of people who were just beginning to learn their Hebrew roots. And that epistle says this: "Let us hold fast the confession of our hope without wavering, for he who has promised is faithful. And let us consider how to stir up one another to love and to good works, not neglecting to meet together, but encouraging one another, and all the more as you see the day drawing near. Peace be unto you."